There was an article in the New York Times about a year ago by the author was Katie Hafner, and the article was called "The Epidemic of Loneliness." And she was talking a lot about efforts in the UK, but you know there are a lot of similarities between the US and UK, and a lot of this refers to the US as well. But she was talking about an effort in the British government to combat loneliness. And this was not just it wasn't just like a social service experiment or a social service, sort of effort. They actually looked at this as an issue of public health. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But one of the things that they did, they came up with a helpline. You know, we have Ask a Nurse. And so they came up with this helpline called the Silver Line. And it's a 24-hour call center for older adults who were looking for contact with other people. They could call and talk to somebody. And so the reason that the British government did this was they realized that this issue of loneliness, research was showing that as a predictor of early death, loneliness eclipses obesity. In other words, loneliness will kill you faster than obesity. That's incredible. I had no idea. Studies in the U.S. and the U.K. show loneliness amongst those 60 and over ranging from 10% to 46% of that population. In other words, just about half of people over 60 struggle with serious loneliness. You know, not like a fleeting feeling. There's an area of the brain that generates feelings of loneliness, and the dopamine that is generated there surges. So it drops at times, but it surges when people engage with other people. You know, dopamine is this happy hormone that makes you feel good. And chronic loneliness is associated with increased levels of cortisol, which is a major stress hormone, as well as increased blood pressure, decreased blood flow to vital organs. Loneliness does all this. There's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, and he's the director of the university's Center for Neuroscience. He said this: denying you feel lonely makes no more sense than denying you feel hunger. So just don't pretend, because it's real. But the problem is that, in our society, it carries kind of a stigma, right? You know, tell somebody, well, I'm feeling kind of lonely. Then what's the implication? Well, I'm a little, you're not really very strong. You sort of need to lean on other people. I wouldn't want that. but there's a little bit of a stigma associated with it. And this shows up in the experience of the people that started this call center, the Silver Line. They found that almost never do people call up and say that they're lonely. They say all sorts of other things, like, how do I cook a turkey? You know, or many people call more than once a day. One woman calls every hour to ask what time it is. And it's kind of sweet in a way. She wants to talk to somebody. She doesn't care what time it is. She wants to know that somebody cares about her. Recently, a caller in his 80s shared a list of his favorite films. The next caller played "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" on his harmonica. Now, I'd love to hear that. The next one after that, an 88-year-old man spent 30 minutes sharing about dogs that he had owned, boats that he had captained, and his memories of London during the Blitz. And see, that's my, my parents' generation. My dad's 84. We'll be 84 in the spring. And they have very vivid memories of London during the Blitz. So this phone service receives 10,000 calls a week. And that's just one. There are others. What does that tell you? People were made to be connected. People were made to be in community. They were made to have contact with other people. And, this isn't news. It shouldn't be news to us as Christians, because, God himself said in Genesis 2:18 about Adam, who he created, "It is not good that he should be alone. I will make him a helper as his partner." Well, then God created that. That wasn't the point where he made Eve. That's where he made all the animals. So he says, it's not good for man to be alone. Let's create all the animals. He creates all the animals, and then guess what? There still was not found a suitable helper, not even man's best friend. It's hard to imagine, I know. So that's then God created for Adam a partner, Eve, and that's when he established the partnership of marriage. But, you know, marriage is not the only connection that people have. There are lots of other ways that we can be connected. When God led the Israelites out of Egypt, he set down all kinds of rules. You know, we know the Ten Commandments, but there are lots of other detailed rules, and a lot of them had to do with how you interact with each other. They were meant to be in community, and a lot of times you had major problems that were going to come up with living in community. But this has continued, you know, for the church in our time, for the New Testament church. The book of Acts describes the church living, if not literally in the same homes, you know, maybe in some cases they did, but they were living as an integral part of each other's lives, you know, where they knew that somebody was hurting financially, and so they would figure out a way to meet that need. So the writer of Ecclesiastes sees the same problem in his day. He bookends verses 7 and 8 with his favorite word. What's you guys that have been here, what's the writer of Ecclesiastes' favorite word? Vanity, yeah. Meaningless. And he actually says it before and after these two verses. So you know he really means it. So this is the life that he describes as meaningless. A person who has no other. Isn't that profound? This is meaningless. A person who has no other. Nobody that cares about him. Nobody that if they were not there, they would note it. Somebody would notice. Somebody would care. That's the definition of a meaningless life, is to be alone. Now, he didn't say to live alone. And, you know, in this case, the person he's talking about, this man, it's possible he doesn't have children or siblings, you know, because they would be logically the ones that would share the earnings from his work. Now, it's possible he does have children and siblings, but he doesn't want to share his wealth with them, so he doesn't have anything to do with them. But either way, whichever it is, the result of a guy living like that is that there is no end to his toil. He works all the time. Why? Well, there's nobody to help him. But he doesn't seem to notice, because his eyes are never satisfied with riches. He's willing to pour himself into his work because he can't stop coming up with stuff he wants to buy. And so he needs to keep on working. So he never asks the question the teacher asks. For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? But he's doing exactly that, but he doesn't realize it. So that, this blind workaholism, that is meaningless and an unhappy business. And this man, like the people calling the silver line, desperately needs to be in a relationship, but he doesn't realize it. And that is what the teacher says. That's the saddest part of all. It's not the saddest part to be alone or to be lonely. It is to not realize it. Now, is this not a perfect description of life in 21st century America? I mean, we have more tools to, you know, we only really need one tool, but we have more tools to connect us with other people than we've ever had before, and yet we are more isolated than we ever have been before. And maybe it's because the tools have taken the place of the most natural kind of contact, the most old-fashioned kind of contact, which is person to person. You know, 15 years ago, we've talked about this before, 15 years ago, dating websites were considered the height of tackiness. Like, only people who couldn't get a date some other way would go on a dating website. You know, some of you remember those days. And it was like, you went on Match? Okay. I'll see you later. And now, it's gotten to the point, it's totally flipped the other way, that you cannot, it's almost virtually impossible to meet somebody, person to person. I read this, I don't know if it's an article or what, about this guy who was, you know, like in a coffee shop, and he just walked up to a girl and he said, "Hi, my name's Bob. What's yours?" And she just completely freaked out and walked out, because she didn't want to meet somebody. She wanted to look up his profile first and check him out, you know, and make sure that he's not a creep. And it's gotten to the point where if you don't have a social media profile, people wonder if you really exist. Like, I don't think you're real. Wait a minute. Poke, poke, poke. That's kind of the extent to which it's gotten. Now, the problem, you know, if you know me, the problem is not the technology itself. I'm not asking you to throw away your phones. The problem is that we have allowed technology to be our master rather than our servant. We are not dictating to it how it is going to enhance our life. We are allowing it to dictate to us how that's going to happen. People need to be in real person-to-person contact with other people. Okay, so let's look at the benefits of community. Why is it so important to be connected to other people? Verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. So this principle is pretty easy to get, pretty basic. Two people are able to accomplish more work than one person alone. If you've ever started a small business, you know, construction or subcontracting, you know, you understand this. You don't have the money to hire somebody. So it's always better to start a partnership than it is a sole proprietorship. You know, my brother-in-law and I figured this out painting houses. You know, 40-foot ladder is kind of heavy for one person to carry. So it was just really handy to have the two of us. Two people can do just about anything, just about any job. One person, it's really a liability. And it's awfully quiet working by yourself all the time. But the article I cited from earlier mentioned this amazing idea somebody came up with in Australia. It's called a men's shed. And it's like a community center. And I don't know what they use as a building, but they use, you know, like a shed, I guess a large shed. And it's a place where men, particularly retired men, can come together, they can hang out, they can work with tools, and they can meet other men. Now, is that not a great idea? And what some of the men that had become a part of, and they're popping up all over Europe, all over, not only Australia, but England, different parts of Europe. And, you know, these men say things like, you know, I know that we're the idea of a man is that he can, you know, he doesn't really need other people, but it's not true. And not only is it not true at an emotional or a social level, but it's literally killing us. And so this idea has really, really caught on. We need each other. Cue the commercial for the men's breakfast, which we just had yesterday. Really was. It was a great time. We, you know, I could hear guys talking about, you know, mountain biking and health problems and jobs, and then John Snyder shared about how he sees God glorified in his work. And it was just a really precious time. And you know, we need that. We need to connect with other people in different ways. So next, the teacher gives us three different scenarios where two are better than one. All of them have to do with ancient Near East travel. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. So the first one is safety. So in ancient times, if you were traveling on foot, you know, it was potentially really deadly. You don't have streetlights. You don't have, you know, probably paved roads. You don't have vehicles with lights. You don't even have those little LED things you can strap on your head and, you know, light up. So this was a very dangerous possibility. On top of that, you had lots of places in Palestine. Last week, I think we mentioned there were lots of rocks. But not only that, you had pits. There was these pits called bitumen pits, where you have petroleum of some form that bubbles up from the ground, mixes with water, and it's not like falling into a pit of asphalt, but it's like slime. You know, just, I would imagine, really nasty to fall into. And so how do you prevent, you know, how do you be protected from all these hazards? You travel with another person. Jesus, when he sent people out, disciples out, what did he do? He sent them out two by two. So you wanted a traveling companion. So the next scenario is if you're traveling in cold weather, you need somebody to keep you warm. So, you know, this is not necessarily talking about a romantic relationship. This is just a necessity. You know, there was no propane heaters. There were no sleeping bags. You basically, you stop on the side of the road and you throw a couple of cloaks on. And if there's somebody else, their body heat will help keep you warm. Could literally protect your life in that circumstance. So safety, warmth. The third one is protection from danger of other people. And if you know the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10, this is where a guy's traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he gets waylaid by robbers and beaten up and left for dead. And then it's not until a person, the right person, the compassionate person, comes along that he's helped. So if he had had somebody with him, maybe that would have happened. Wouldn't have happened. So now, interestingly enough, this is where the famous quote, "A threefold cord is not easily broken," shows up. And you know, countless weddings have had this as an illustration of marriage. And I just did one this summer where they had a little threefold cord that they wove together. And it was really beautiful. It was a great picture. And, you know, the Bible tells us that marriage is a picture of our union, our connection with Jesus Christ. It is infinitely stronger than any merely horizontal relationship. That's where the threefold cord comes from. You know, the two members of the marriage and God in the middle. Marriage certainly comes with challenges. There are things that you deal with in marriage that you might not deal with if you were single. But it's interesting to note that a lot of studies have shown that marriage is actually good for you as far as your health. It helps. There are a number of studies that have linked marriage to lower rates of cardiovascular disease, cancer, respiratory disease, and mental illness. And it actually helps the members cope with stress. And so, you know, having said all that about marriage, surprisingly enough, the context of this statement about the threefold cord, it's not actually about marriage. It's about friendship in general. The context of this statement about a threefold cord is it's not marriage, but it's actually a fight. Now, normally those two things don't go together. Well, sometimes they do. But in this case, the threefold cord statement comes from the Gilgamesh epic, actually, where the main character is asking his friend to come fight a dragon with him, or this monster, to slay a monster. And he uses this illustration of a threefold cord that's connecting their two ships together. And so he uses a sort of an illustration of friendship. So it's a picture of the value of friendship for those who are willing to make the commitment. I saw a great illustration of this recently. We watched the movie Bucket List with Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman. And Nicholson in this movie plays a billionaire who buys up struggling hospitals and runs them for a profit. And unfortunately, he runs them at a profit at the expense of the patients, normally. So he has this saying when he buys the hospital. He says, "I run hospitals, not health spas. Two people to a room, no exceptions." So he takes pride in this. But unfortunately, one day, he gets sick. He comes down with, he's diagnosed with cancer. So he has to stay in one of his own hospitals. I almost said hotels. It is not a hotel. So he stays in his own hospital. And he ends up with Morgan Freeman. Now, I would think it would be really cool to end up in a hospital room with Morgan Freeman. I don't know about you. He just seems like a fascinating guy. But Jack Nicholson's character was not so enthralled. And he says to his assistant, "Get me out of here. I want my own room." And his assistant says, "Two people to a room, no exceptions." It's so funny. He was very angry. So he and Morgan Freeman, I'm just going to use their actors' names, you know, if you don't care about the characters' names. So these two guys go through the trials and tribulations of cancer treatments, and they're watching each other, you know, getting physically sick and helping each other. And so they go from being, you know, sort of strangers at odds with each other to real friends over a period of a few months. And so they get to the end of their treatment, and they're both given 6 months to a year to live. And so they decide to go on a trip and experience everything that they can before their time is up. And what I found so striking about this film is that Morgan Freeman's character is portrayed as an actual, as far as I can tell, an actual Bible-believing, praying, evangelizing Christian, and not a jerk. You know, that part was really surprising, because normally somebody who is a Bible-believing, praying, evangelizing Christian is a jerk, you know, in Hollywood movies. That's just the way it goes. But he is not portrayed that way at all. And it's Nicholson's character who's this, you know, very greedy, very immoral, but a very lonely man who has everything. He has everything you could possibly want except anybody that cares about him. Nobody in his life cares about him. So you have this tremendous contrast between a Christian of really humble means and you know, who has a family that loves him, and then this atheist, which he is basically an atheist. He's got everything, and yet he has nothing. It's very powerful. But anyway, I found the words that Nicholson's character spoke at his friend's funeral to be the most striking part. he was testifying to how much he loved this man, Carter, in the short time that they knew him. And he said, "The last months of his life were the best months of mine. He saved my life, and he knew it before I did. I'm deeply proud that this man found it worth his while to know me." Now, forget about the deeply proud part, okay? You know, just whatever. But what he found significant was that this man found it worth his while to know another person, to invest time, to care about him, to pour his life into somebody else's life. It mattered. He noticed that, and he said, "Not only did I notice it, it changed my life." You see, deep down inside, every human being needs to be known. We need to be known in order just to survive. You can't live if somebody doesn't know you, if somebody doesn't care about you. However, God wants more than that for us. He wants us more than just to survive. So that kind of leads us to this last part, the responsibility of community. Now, there's a story in this last section, verses 13 to 16. It's very, you probably picked this up, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. And the language is very difficult in the original. So I'm going to give you what I believe to be a faithful interpretation. And I'll sort of interject some commentary here. "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew to take advice. For he, that is the youth, went from prison to the throne, replacing the foolish king." So you have a king who's on the throne. He's foolish. He doesn't listen to anybody. So he loses his throne, and this wise but poor youth who was in prison ends up taking his place. "Though in his own kingdom he had been born poor." This is the young guy. "I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was not end of all the people, all of whom he led." So the foolish king had a responsibility for all of the community of the people under his rule. He had a responsibility to ask for good advice and then to take good advice. You know, he was supposed to listen to his counselors. Ultimately, he needed to listen to his people. He needed to care about his people, and he didn't. And he failed to do that, so he lost his kingdom to one who would do that. So, you know, we have a story with a great moral here. Living in community demands responsibility, right? If you're going to live in community, it requires something of you. It doesn't just happen. So the poor but wise young man learned that lesson from his predecessor, and living in community here in the church requires responsibility. It requires us to listen to each other. We must value each other in order to do life together. You can't live for yourself and expect to function as a healthy body. It's a great lesson for us. But then the teacher goes on, and this is where it gets a little confusing. "Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind." So it seems that what he's saying here is, even when you do it right, even when you understand your responsibility in community, even if you reach the pinnacle of success as the ruler of a nation, guess what? More than likely, people will forget you after you're dead. And they might even throw you out of office. Okay, I can't help it. Just ask Terry Francona and John Farrell, both managers of the Red Sox, who won a World Series and then 4 years later lost their jobs. So, sorry, random sports reference. Forgive me, those of you who don't follow that, but... You could, church history reference. You could ask Jonathan Edwards, who led the first Great Awakening and then was fired. Job security is a fleeting thing. So, you know, what he's saying is people are fickle that way. You can do it right. You can show your responsibility in community, and yet it can be seemingly all for nothing. So here's the question. Does that last part throw a wrench in everything that the teacher told us about two being better than one? You know, does it take away from it? Well, here's my thought. I think that little wrench that he throws in at the end is exactly what we need to do more than just take a good moral from this, but to actually see Jesus in this passage. And let me explain. The best and most well-ordered life comes to an end and might well be forgotten by most people. what is done under the sun is not what lasts, is it? It's what is above the sun. It's what is eternal. That's what matters. That's what we've been learning throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. You see, this helps us to see why the Christian gospel is essential to true community. Think about this. What is it that the church offers that no other organization does when it comes to community? What benefits of this kind of community are distinctive? Is it, you know, we have a place to belong? Well, not really. You can get that anywhere. You can get that at the Y. You can get that a lot of other Lions Club, a lot of organizations you can belong to. Is it a place where everybody knows your name? Well, we know where you can get that. Is it a place to learn about God and the Bible? Well, it is, but you can get that other places. You can get that in seminary, Bible college, a Christian school, online, podcasts. You can get that in a lot of places. Is it a place to get biblical counsel? Go to a Christian counselor. You can get that there. Is it a place to get solid values for your children? Well, you don't really need the church for that. Is it a place to experience inspiring worship? Well, you can always go to a concert, right? Isn't it interesting? These are all things that people look at and they say, hey, this is what we get from the church. But there's none of those things can you not get somewhere else. So what is it about the church's community that is different? The secret lies in the questions that Josiah answered this morning. And I want to pick out two of them. Do you acknowledge yourself to be a sinner in the sight of God, justly deserving his displeasure and without hope except in his sovereign mercy? Do you submit yourself to the government and discipline of the church? Now, those questions might not be the first thing that come to your mind when you're thinking about community. But I think maybe they should be. Because the church it's the only place this side of heaven where we freely acknowledge our status as sinners in need of God's mercy. And this "and" is really important, and we voluntarily come under the authority of other sinners in need of God's mercy for God's glory and for our good. It's the only place that happens. True community is driven by need, and it grows in the garden of transparent submission. You know what that means? True community is driven by our need of the gospel, our need of God's grace, and it grows, it is cultivated as we are transparent about our sin and as we submit, as we come under the authority of others. Anything else is just another club. This alone is what the church offers. And so I want to encourage you to join with us. You know, maybe if you haven't taken that step. We don't pretend to know everything about doing community. You know, we're pretty bad at some elements of it. But I want to encourage you to walk with us and help us to learn what it looks like to live in community. Give us your ideas. Help us to get better at it until, you know, we can do it perfectly. Because this is what it means to be His people. Let's pray. Father in heaven, you know that we need help. We need your help in this area. Because we live in a country that is kind of dedicated to the rugged individual, and we're a part of that. And at times we resist it. Sometimes it's just easier. But Lord, I ask that you would help us to be your people. To be distinctively your people in this world. And I pray that would be attractive, that people would see the difference. And Lord, work in us, even through the community of the Lord's Supper. And as you do that, we'll give you thanks and praise. In Jesus' name, amen.